Hey Rollers, it's Josh from Quid Pro Roll, your favorite soup-slinging, wacky wrestling, dragon-defenestrating actual play podcast. Are you interested in epic prophecies, frazzled GMs, arson? Check us out! While you're at it, check out the other sweet shows on the May Contain Action Network. Forgotten Paths, Unvaulted, May Contain Action, and the Goblins and Growlers podcast, all linked here in the show notes.
Hey Goblins, Brandon here. If you enjoy what we do and you'd like to help support us create more and maybe even take the podcast to weekly, then the best way right now that you can support us is to head over to patreon.com/goblinsgrowlers. You can find all the different stuff we do there, one-page dungeons, bonus audio for things, all kinds of stuff. So head on over there, and even if it's just a dollar or, you know, however much you're comfortable doing, or if you can't put anything toward the Patreon, just tell a friend about it. Tell somebody about the podcast. That's another great way to support us. So, patreon.com/goblinsgrowlers, and we'll see y'all soon.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Goblins and Growlers podcast. I'm Josh Maltby, at Black Cloak DM on the places you can find me.
I'm Brandon Dingus, at Wave Brandalore on social media. I'll just say it that way. Thank you everybody for listening to this week's episode. Hopefully it's not too wonky because Josh and I are experimenting with sort of a new recording setup on this one, and there's bound to be bugs to work out on this thing. So if audio drops, we'll fix it before we release it. But if there's awkwardness, just give us a pass. We would really appreciate it.
I think they're listening to a TTRPG themed podcast. There's going to be some awkwardness that they anticipate.
Oh, it's just baked in. It's on the tin. But we got a handful of things to talk about. You know, last week we were very much a targeted podcast on one topic, and we gave you 90 minutes of caveman glory for the Born from Ice Kickstarter. And just a quick shout out to the Born from Ice Kickstarter, because I looked at it yesterday and it had been up for like 6 days, and they're 75% of the way there to their $40,000 goal. And, you know, we had Lauren Small on, had a great hour and a half conversation. So we're changing it up a little bit. This time we're going to talk about a handful of different things for shorter periods of time in case you just want some nuggets on things. But I'm ready to jump right into it if you are, Josh.
Oh, I'm 100% ready to jump right into it.
Okay.
To start everything out, you know that we've been promoting more of our stuff on YouTube. And
right.
Brandon noticed this absolutely massive comment on our Is Black Flag Still Relevant video. And I've already forgotten the username because I'm that bad with names.
It's Colin the Benevolent Bandit.
Bandit.
Colin the Benevolent, yeah. But yeah. I almost said druid for some reason, but yeah, you know, a couple times a week I log in and check the back end of the YouTube channel, and that's where I get the alerts for comments and things like that. And I saw this, I was like, oh, because for whatever reason that video has been getting a little bit more traction in the last few days. And I saw this on there, and I started reading it, and then you go over into the menu and you click on more in your back end comment menu, and it just completely filled the screen more or less with the comment. If you're watching the video version of this, I'm going to put it up on screen right now. And it's a real healthy chunk of a comment, but this was on our video for Is Project Black Flag Still Relevant? And you'll remember that we talked a lot in that episode just about our feelings on the whole thing. And I said something to the effect of like, hey, you know what they should call 5e? Oh, they should call it the generic universal role-playing system because it's just so ubiquitous. But this person just took that and ran with it. You know, they're like, oh, well, you know, laugh my fucking ass off. That's a great name for it. This is without a doubt the world we live in. Anyone believing otherwise is in denial. So just, you know, basically agreeing with the idea that D&D is sort of preeminent and everybody else is just kind of a pretender to it. What were your takeaways from the comment? We just felt like it was, the person put so much effort into it, we felt like we had to talk about it. So thank you, Colin, the Benevolent Bandit, for dropping us this comment.
Yes, thank you for sending this in, because it was fun to read, and I agree mostly with you. There's a lot of talk about how 5e, once it became Creative Commons, all of a sudden these companies that were like, oh yeah, we're gonna make something completely different, all of a sudden they're backpedaling. And his argument is that the folks who backed these particular systems didn't back them because they wanted something that was 5e adjacent. They backed them because they basically were saying, hey, we appreciate that you said F you to WotC and supported the community of GMs and players during the OGL mess. And I think that's 100% accurate. I agree with that completely. The part where I disagree slightly is at the end, where they're like, the most honest thing to do would be to return the $4.5 million they raised on BackerKit and go, we messed up. And yeah, once WotC made the 5e SRD Creative Commons, we should have just stopped, and here's your money back.
Yeah. And yeah, I agree with you, because, you know, looking back in another part of the comment, it says that, you know, there's no path to success for these games. And they misjudged sort of the financial backing that they were going to be able to get from the community. But the fact that these Kickstarters funded means they judged that support correctly for the limited product that they wanted to create based on that Kickstarter. So it's like, you know, they met the goal on that. And I don't think they owe anybody any money. Like, I think that people who supported those Kickstarters for those products at the time that they were out there, like right after the OGL controversy, I think there was maybe some emotional decision making made with backing, but that's not the fault of the recipient of the money, you know?
Right.
Like, people may regret supporting them because of the way things shook out. But number one, there was no way we could have predicted that that's how things were going to shake out. And number two, like, that's just what happens. You know, you support a thing, and they could have canceled their pledge too.
I think it's perfectly reasonable to express disappointment about things being too much like 5e. Mm-hmm. I think that's sensible. And I think backers should 100%, if they feel that way, be expressing that. But I disagree with the concept that they should be refunding the money and they should be basically going, we've been bested by WotC once more. Because the reason I make such a fuss about being disappointed about the direction they ended up taking is not because I think that they have written this all, it's set in stone, they're never going to change direction, they're never going to adjust course. I think that those things are very realistic to occur if they receive feedback that these are things that are kind of disappointing for their player base. Mm-hmm. The more they hear, hey, you know, we actually wanted something that felt familiar to 5e, but was in fact its own system altogether, the more they're going to go, oh, you know what? Then we're missing the mark with Tales of Valiant. And with that being the case, they're going to want to change that. They're going to want to appeal to the people who are backing them and supporting them while still appealing to a broader base. And I think that's the difference here, is when I'm talking about being disappointed and I'm like, I wish you guys would be doing more stuff like this, I see that as a critique, not a criticism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the difference between those two things is, it can be a very thin line, but it's something where I want to see this change because I'm excited about the work they do and I want to see them succeed in the work that they do.
Mm-hmm. And I'm growing, and this is nobody's fault, I'm just growing increasingly tired of this conversation just overall. And I don't mean that, and I'm not saying that critically at anybody. I'm not criticizing our commenter for bringing it up because they were piggybacking off of something I said. So, like, I have no business doing that. But all I'm saying is, you know, anybody who is saying, and I'll just generalize just because I think I can in this circumstance, but anybody who's like, oh, like, I don't like playing D&D. I don't like 5e. Like, they're usually coming from two camps there. Camp one is they want to actually play sort of a different kind of game that 5e is not going to let them do. And then camp number two is they just don't want to support WotC, which, like, there's virtues to both of the approaches that I'm talking about there, right? But by and large, I think most people really don't care what the system is. They want something that their friends know how to play. They want something they can learn pretty easy just so they can start doing it. So I think we're going down, like, multiple levels into a niche when we start getting to a point of, like, oh, well, you know, this system isn't going to work. You know, I don't want to play 5e because this reason, this reason, this reason.
I disagree with you only in the sense that I think people do care what they play and who's publishing it, or else these probably would not have raised $4.5 million.
Well, let me disagree with you on that, because yeah. I think this all has to be looked at through that lens of the OGL controversy, where emotions were running high on things. And I think without that as a catalytic event for it, people didn't care. I think it was WotC who had essentially, you know, given you all this stuff ostensibly for free for many years, was now saying, well, like, you can't have it for free anymore. Like, giving you something and then taking it away and then trying to take it away. Like, nobody likes that. And that's what triggered all this response to it. And I think absent that, people just aren't that particular about their system unless they're trying to achieve a very particular goal or a very particular kind of game. Like, if you desperately want to play, like, a superhero game, you're going to be playing Masks or Mutants and Masterminds or something like that. You're probably not going to be playing 5e. But if you're just like, hey, I just want to, like, let's just get together and play a TTRPG or something like that, most people would probably be like, hey, you know, let's just use 5e.
I think that's probably accurate. I think the differentiator for me is people got emotional about 5e taking away, or about WotC, I should say, taking away the 5e OGL, because third-party publishers got angry about it. Like, mm-hmm. I don't think individual players were mad on their own behalf. So on that stance, I think you're correct. But the third-party publishers make a big difference when it comes to stuff like this. So if Tales of the Valiant is offering something where, you know, they've got their own OGL that you can do your own work with, et cetera, and it's different and it's not WotC, then I could absolutely see third-party publishers migrating. And if third-party publishers are migrating, they're going to bring their fans and their audiences as much as they can with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with you. I think that's a little bit of an uphill battle, but I think that is when I'm talking about, like, people do care what system they're playing. I think that's kind of what I mean, is that you get these places like Kobold Press, which mm-hmm. create really excellent materials, and they build a fan base of their own. I mean, I think that's why MCDM exists at all, is because Matt Colville has a huge following.
Oh, for sure.
And he can pivot. So I think if third-party publishers come along with them, then that's great. But whether or not that occurs, we'll see when those systems exist out in the world.
I mean, yeah, but the whole idea of everybody trying to pursue a strategy of we're going to replace 5e with our system was just doomed to failure from the beginning. Like, the only logical outcome from that was balkanization, and you're going to have a couple of larger gorillas in that picture, like your Kobold Press, for example. Like, there's going to be the larger of the smaller ones, like when an empire breaks up and there are some larger countries versus a lot of smaller countries. And there was not going to be a winner for a long time. It was going to be a race to King of the Mountain, and it probably would have taken a little bit. So this was the best outcome for third party publishers. But I think we've got a little bit off track from this. But anyway,
yeah.
Anyway, thank you for your comment, Colin. We appreciate it. It's, you know, I was complaining about getting tired of having this conversation, and I'm really not, because it's an interesting conversation to have. Because I think it'll be interesting in, like, you know, 2 or 3 years to look back at, like, probably more like 3 or 4 years to look back at what sales numbers are for a lot of these would be 5e replacements as they were conceived, which ultimately ended up they're destined to become also RANs, but you know, there was a time where they thought 5e was changing a lot more fundamentally and they would possibly replace it. It'll be really interesting to see what their player bases turn out to be over time.
Well, particularly as we start looking at WotC's no longer publishing things for 5e SRD style content, third-party publishers are publishing things that are compatible, much like Pathfinder 1e was with 3.5. They're publishing things that are compatible with 5e. And then the third-party publishers that during the 5e OGL breakup were like, we're going to do something that is, we're going to build something and it's going to be different and it's not going to be WotC. It'll be interesting to see what that range of things looks like and where everybody ends up landing in 3 to 5 years time.
Yeah.
So I'm excited to see how it develops. I still hope that Kobold Press continues deviating away from WotC rule sets. Not because I think WotC rule sets are bad, but because I think Kobold Press is a creative enough organization that whatever they come up with, I think is going to be a little bit different and a little bit fascinating. And I'm excited for what it could be.
Yeah, and for all we know, they have a long game about just sort of getting people in the door with 5e and then weaning them off of it into something else when they have Tales of the Valiant 2e in several years. So who knows?
Yeah,
Who knows? I also think that's a losing strategy, but that also depends. That also depends sort of on where D&D XE is in the zeitgeist at that point.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
100% for sure. Okay. Let's move from there into news item number two. Since we last talked about Vecna, Eve of Ruin, we've gotten a little bit more details about what the module is going to involve. It's going to be another one of their $70, you know, as all of them are now, $70. I think, does that include, Brandon, you've got the page up. Does that include the digital version?
Yeah, that's physical and digital. It's $69.95.
Yeah, and so it's $60 for just physical, probably.
Probably.
So it's going to be a 256-page book. There's going to be 32 maps, a bunch of new monsters, a bunch of lore. It's going to be the thing that we had not known before, which I'm kind of excited about, frankly, is that it's going to be a level 10 to level 20 module, which is not something that Wizards has done much of in the past. And having that higher level content is something nice for those of us who have always played in the level 1 to level 7 range for the most part, very occasionally tiptoeing just above that before the campaign falls apart.
Yeah. And it's going to have a double-sided poster map, so it's going to be probably a lot like Planescape, where you just have it perforated in the back of the book, and then you have to pull it out and unfold it, which I don't like that because you have the potential of tearing it when you're pulling it out of there. It's going to have detailed character dossiers with insights into allies who you may recognize from other adventures. So I'm imagining we're going to see like your Tasselhoff Burfoot. We're going to see your Raislin. Maybe a Llewellyn Loquacious makes an appearance or something like that. So we'll just see folks that people are familiar with. Right. And, you know, we had known this was going to be a multiversal adventure, but only just sort of vaguely, because when they like, it wasn't even when they announced it, but it was in the days following the announcement where they're like, oh, yeah, it's going to be a trip around the D&D multiverse. And the part of that that I would love to just talk about for a second is it says Vecna Eve of Ruin is a high stakes Dungeons & Dragons adventure in which the fate of the multiverse hangs in the balance. The heroes begin in the Forgotten Realms and travel to Planescape, Spelljammer, Eberron, Ravenloft, Dragonlance, and Greyhawk as they race to save existence from obliteration. What's missing there? Oh, we've talked about it, and we've talked about why it's probably going to stay missing.
Oh, Dark Sun.
Yeah. Athas not represented here.
Maybe they'll make some vague head nods at Dark Sun to appease those of us who demand to know where Dark Sun is in the mix.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because it says Travel to Planescape, which they've released a 5e for. Spelljammer, which they've released a 5e for. Eberron, 5e. Ravenloft, 5e. Dragonlance, they either did or... It wasn't a major release.
It was not a major release. Yeah. It's the Shadow of the Dragon Queen, I want to say.
That's right.
Was a Dragonlance setting, but they also released it with a board game, and it did not get, between the book and the board game, it did not get the sort of traction they were hoping for, which has led a lot of people to be like, oh, I don't know that they're going to do anything in Dragonlance for a really long time because of this. And I don't think that's the case. I think what they're going to do is stuff like this, where they're like, oh, yes, our wide and varied multiverse. Here's Dragonlance again.
Now, they haven't had a Greyhawk release for 5e, have they?
I don't think so. There's nothing I can think of that is Greyhawk specific.
Yeah, I can't either. You know, anybody listening to this, please tell us that we're wrong. Now, obviously, we could just Google this, but how professional would that be? as Josh mutes his microphone and starts tapping on his keyboard. But no, I don't like if there is a Greyhawk release, it's really minor, but I can't in the last 10 years think of one.
There's nothing coming to mind. And like you said, I could Google it, but in this case, I'll let chat go ahead and correct us either on the Discord or on the YouTube comments.
But bottom line is it really seems like there's a strategy and a sort of willful exclusion of Dragonlance on here, which just Dark Sun. Don't light me up for that. but a willful exclusion of Dark Sun, which backs up, you know, what people in sort of the WotC sphere had been saying. I guess it was 6-8 months ago when we were talking about that. It's just like, I don't really see how that's going to work in nowadays.
I think it was Crawford himself that was like, yeah, there's a lot of problems with that universe that I don't think are very palatable in a modern world.
Yeah,
maybe there's some way to make it work, but right now there's no plans to.
Yeah, and I really feel like this is them, without saying it, just confirming that there's never going to be a Dark Sun release for 5th edition, or perhaps even going forward, like in any edition.
That's certainly possible. I don't know that I would go so far as to say never, but I think there's a lot to be said for the fact that when that statement was made, whether that was Jeremy Crawford or somebody else, that caused a lot of stirred controversy for people, where they're like, oh, you cowards, like what's so wrong? And then people are like, the slavery, the fact that slavery is a big part of Dark Sun as a universe. And they're like, oh, you pansies, WotC doesn't need that kind of heat right now. Let's be real with ourselves. They don't need to be trying to tiptoe through that particular minefield.
No, they don't need to open the door to that. and we've talked about this before, so I'm not going to repeat myself too much, but they could certainly reimagine Dark Sun into something different. But then, like Ship of Theseus, right? Like, is it still Dark Sun at that point?
Right.
Or are they better off just trying to create a new IP that takes the good stuff and does it in a way and eliminates, like, maybe a world of scarcity without the slavery, possibly?
I mean, it's certainly not outside the realm of possibility. And I think there is stuff in Dark Sun that is cool that would be worth ripping out and putting somewhere else. But I don't know that they'll ever use Dark Sun itself just because of how much troublesome stuff is built into it.
Yeah.
And how quickly, if they go, oh, yeah, we're doing a Dark Sun thing, but we've modernized it so that it's a little more palatable for the modern audience, how quickly they're going to have to deal with all of the grognards being like, oh, I can't believe you did this, and you cowards, and blah, 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 and all the negative press that comes with that.
I love how your grognard starts out sounding like Strong Bad, and then corrects himself.
Oh, you guys, I can't believe you would try to hide slavery in your games. Oh.
I didn't mean to take over this conversation with Dark Sun. That was just something I noticed when I was reading this, and I thought it was kind of a glaring omission that sort of confirms everything that we've heard.
Honestly, I think we were pretty much done with the details we hadn't already shared. Obviously, Vecna is here because it's celebrating 50 years of D&D.
Vecna's also here because Stranger Things brought Vecna back to the public consciousness.
Also a thing. Although, didn't Stranger Things bring Vecna back to the public consciousness like 2 or 3 years ago?
That's 2 or 3 years more recently than like sort of the last time, you know, Vecna was it like
when
anybody, like any average person might know the name Vecna, you know?
All right. Now I have to, I know I wasn't going to go Google things, you but won't. Now I need to know. Vecna Lives, I think, was the most recent release that had Vecna, wasn't it?
I think.
That's 1990.
Okay.
It's been a minute.
Yeah. Yeah.
I needed to know when that was from, because that was the last time I recalled hearing about a Vecna-centric. That was Greyhawk.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah. That's, yeah. Only, okay. Maybe.
Only 34 years ago.
Yeah. I just think without Stranger Things, like, this wouldn't necessarily be about Vecna. It could be something else that's telling the same story. But I think Vecna really benefits from his appearance on a very popular television show.
That is totally fair and reasonable. Here is my question for you, because I'm a constant conspiracy theorist when it comes to these sorts of tie-ins.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that the production crew for Stranger Things, whether it was the writer or the producer or the director, whoever, reached out to Watsy and said, hey, we're doing Stranger Things. God, what was that? Season 4?
That was 4 or 5, yeah.
And we're going to do our big bad villain. Who do you want us to use? Or do you think they said, hey, we're thinking about using Vecna as that chill?
I think the former is more likely than the latter. But if that was what happened, I don't think there was any long-term plan in place on Watsy's end of like, yeah, you know, the 50th anniversary is coming up soon and we should do something to make Vecna more popular.
We'll start work on that right before we lay off a bunch of Hasbro employees.
Yeah. Yeah. I just think it's kismet that it worked out the way it did for that. And it's just, and it's made Vecna more of a household name with D&D. So
I think that's fair.
Yeah. I mean, it's good for everybody. But you know, all that to say, like, if it weren't for that, we would still be getting this story probably just because of the way the multiverse is sort of in pop culture now. It just might not be with Vecna. But I think it's interesting that Vecna is just trying to, you know, take over the multiverse like a Marvel villain.
I think, isn't he trying to destroy the multiverse? Isn't that what they said?
It says weaving a ritual to eliminate good, obliterate the gods, and subjugate all worlds. Stop Vecna before he remakes the universe. The heroes work with three of the multiverse's most famous archmages, travel to far-flung locales, and rebuild the legendary rod of 7 parts. So that three most famous archmages, so yeah, Raistlin probably is in there. This is some real Thanos shit here that Vecna is doing, remaking the universe in his image.
That'd be Raistlin Elminster?
Yeah.
I don't know who number 3 is. Somebody either on the Discord or YouTube comments is going to be like, how could you not know number 3?
Yeah, it's Jose, but it's Jose Carrera. Some people will get that joke. Those are the kind of jokes I tell for Craig. And then and then days later, he's like, I got that joke in the Discord.
It's a wrestler, isn't it?
No, there's the three tenors. There's Domingo, Pavarotti, and then Jose Carrera, and nobody ever remembers the third guy.
Oh
yeah,
dang it.
Yeah,
well, I walked right into that one myself then.
Uh-huh.
Oh well,
you just proved it true is all.
Oh,
you did.
Oh well,
yeah. But one last thing about the Vecna adventure, I think, before we move on, but keep in mind that if you pre-order on D&D Beyond, you get a special like one shot, like single session adventure, Vecna Nest of the Eldritch Eye, and it's only available with digital pre-order. So from everything that they're saying, it is not coming out separately or physically or anything like that. You just have to get it through D&D Beyond. So if that's your jam, just make sure you do the pre-order on D&D Beyond.
I will say, as someone who very prominently tries to promote our friendly local gaming stores, being married to someone who owns one, I feel like they tend to release these pre-order bonus adventures as part of the digital pack. But what I don't know is if they're doing, because they did for Shadow of the Dragon Queen, where if you bought a physical copy, you could be like, oh yeah, I would also like digital assets as well at a significantly reduced price. I don't know if they're doing that for this one.
Yeah. And you can't bet on it.
You cannot bet on it. But I would strongly urge folks to be supporting their friendly local gaming stores.
Yeah.
Because when you buy it direct from D&D Beyond, WotC pockets all of the money, and then your friendly local gaming store is like, need water.
All I'm saying is that from what WotC is saying, it sounds like they're not going to have Nest of the Eldritch Eye, unless you get it on D&D Beyond.
It's totally possible. So totally possible.
I'm just giving the people the information is all I'm doing.
Reasonable and fair.
Yeah. Are we ready to move on to the next thing?
Yes, I think we are, which will be the meat of the episode. We got this as a suggestion, if I could speak English, from one of our listeners, Drayden, that NASA put out a TTRPG adventure, and I was like, well, why are we being so vague about that? Why are we saying tabletop role-playing game adventure? Like, why aren't we saying like 5e, Pathfinder, whatever you built it for? It's because they didn't build it for any of those things. It is meant to be as system agnostic as possible.
And just to set the scene a little bit more, in the Discord, Drayden was saying that, and I was like, what? NASA has produced a TTRPG, because the last time I dealt with something like this, and I know this has kind of been a vogue thing in a lot of product marketing for the last couple of years, but the last time I dealt with this was maybe like 2019, when Wendy's put out the Wendy's TTRPG, and I've recorded a couple of episodes of running that with some people, and it was ridiculous. It was being run on the most 5e, 5e kind of thing. Like, they didn't really deviate anything. They just changed a couple names. And, you know, you had to, at the end of every particular arc in it, it was always touting, like, you know, the crispiness of Wendy's fries or something like that, or the spicy chicken sandwich. All the spells were related to menu items and everything. So that's what I was predisposed to expect from this. And having said that, I think the Wendy's people did a really good job with what they were told to do. It was comically entertaining, and I would have preferred to have a whole fast food multiverse of tabletop games, like the Hardee's game, McDonald's. Like, just as an aside, you really missed out, because you've got the entire sort of McDonaldland IP from the 70s and 80s that you guys could mess with. There's a lot there. Like, you know, you stole it from Sid and Marty Krofft, so you might as well make some money off of it. But
look, what Brandon's trying to say is, McDonald's, if you want us to write you a branded adventure, you just need to let us know and we can talk pricing. OK, all right, reach out.
Yeah, I don't think they will, since I just brought up them stealing McDonaldland from Sid and Marty Krofft again. But anyway, so Drayden's like, hey, NASA put out this TTRPG. You should take a look at it. I took a look at it, and there's charming is a word that I will use to describe this whole thing. It's kind of hilariously charming, I think.
It's clearly built to be kind of an educational resource, the sort of thing that you would put down in front of a like field trip and be like, this is what we're going to do for the next 2 hours. And so there's little bits and pieces that are science related or NASA history related, or talking about like how the Hubble telescope was built. But for the most part, it's a fairly cut and dry high fantasy adventure on kind of an unusual setting, which I think that was the thing that excited me the most.
Yeah, on the Lost Universe website, which is, you know, Lost Universe is the name of this particular adventure, on their website, which of course is hosted on science.nasa.gov, it says it's time to gather your party and your favorite tabletop role-playing game system. So there you go, it's system neutral, play it with whatever you want. A dark mystery has settled over the city of Aldastron on the rogue planet of Exlaris. Researchers dedicated to studying the cosmos have disappeared, and the Hubble Space Telescope has vanished from Earth's timeline. Only an ambitious crew of adventurers can uncover what was lost. Are you up to the challenge? This adventure is designed for a party of 4 to 7, level 7 to 10 characters, and is easily adaptable to your preferred tabletop role-playing game system.
I will say 4 to 7 players at level 7 to 10 will walk through this adventure.
Yeah.
They will not feel like they are being pressured or challenged at almost any point. They will feel like they're having a good time, I think, but they definitely won't be like, oh man, we almost went down there.
I don't think this was written for any sort of hardcore combat-oriented gamers.
No. Again, I think this was written for somebody being on a field trip to a space museum and being like, oh, hell yeah, now we're going to do this for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
So the setting being on a rogue planet, I thought was particularly exciting because for folks that are not familiar with astronomy terms, a rogue planet is a planet that is broken loose from its solar system. And in the case of this particular rogue planet, it broke loose from its solar system because its entire solar system was shattered by a black hole appearing in a nearby solar system.
Mm-hmm.
And so their whole solar system breaks apart and flies away, which they refer to historically in a way that I think we as a people would also do as the breaking.
Uh-huh. But Josh, if a planet breaks away from its star and just goes off into deep space, surely it's going to freeze to death without the warmth of its sun.
Well, yes, that would be accurate. Also, there's no light, so things become pretty difficult for people there. But thankfully, this planet has magic. And that magic is influenced by what the people on the planet refer to as the vacuum, but which you will find as you go through the adventure and you learn a little bit more about space science. And anybody who's planning on playing this adventure as opposed to running this adventure, close your ears for a couple seconds here.
Mm-hmm.
It's dark matter. Dark matter is what makes their magic work.
Is it dark matter or dark energy?
I think it's, you might be right. It might be dark energy. Gosh dang it.
Well, there's a helpful pie chart at the back of the book that explains the composition of the universe. And it's like 5% is visible matter, like 15% is dark matter. And then the remaining like 80% is dark energy.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's dark energy.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, that's in case anybody wants to nitpick our science of magic on this.
So they use the magic from the vacuum, and that magic allows them to put a shield around the planet so that they don't get wiped out by just some random space debris that they happen to encounter, such as meteors, asteroids, etc. And then they additionally use that magic to create solar energy on the planet itself so that they can continue to have things like plant life. The one thing that I think is maybe a bit of a scientific, well, now hold on a minute, is they talk about how they've made it so that there are areas of the planet where the sun never sets because of this magic.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the most productive sections because the crops are so healthy and so fruitful and the sun's just constantly getting those plants to grow. Plants, I realize these could be magic plants because this is a world of magic. Plants generally like to have a break from having the sun beaming on them because the sun is very hot and has a lot of radiation that's part of it. And we don't do very well when we're in the sun constantly for more than a few hours. Plants do better than we do, but they still have their upper limits.
Maybe it's a special kind of magic sunlight that doesn't have radiation. I mean, light is radiation before somebody says that to me. But you know what I mean. I mean the kind of like Hulk-inducing radiation.
Yeah, no gamma rays in there.
Yeah.
That was the one thing that of the science, as I was reading things, I was like, wait a minute, hold on. That doesn't make sense to me. And then I was just like, magic plants. And I kept moving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you really, it took you too long to move on there. You really just need to suspend disbelief a lot quicker. Based on what you just narrated to me to arrive at that point and then say, now here's where I had to stop for a minute and really question the authenticity of this.
Look, it took me out of the science-based nature of most of what's going on in this adventure, yeah. Okay?
When I was reading this, and I mean this to dovetail with sort of the charming description that I used earlier. As I was reading this, my immediate thoughts went to the Martin Landau, Barbara Bain series, Space 1999, from like the late 70s. This is something Craig could probably fact check me on, because I'm sure he knows what I'm talking about. And I will even ask Craig, how long after we started talking about the particulars of this did it take for Space 1999 to pop up in your head? A rogue planet of some sort just barreling through space having adventures that doesn't make any scientific sense.
This episode dedicated to Craig.
Yeah. But yeah, you know, you have to, as with any good science fiction story, except for like a hard sci-fi story, so all you Clarks and Asimovs, you get out of here. But as with any sci-fi or fantasy story, they just sort of establish the parameters of the world right there at the beginning. It's like, look, here's how it is, deal with it, let's move on.
So the only reason I bring that up is because there's a lot of science in the entirety of the adventure, and I appreciate how much science there is in the entirety of the adventure. Mm-hmm. I also appreciated how accurate a lot of that science is portrayed. And so when I came to something that for me feels scientifically inaccurate, I was like, wait a minute, hold on. Uh-huh. And then as I do with these things, I went, that's a plot hole and I'm going to fill it with magic. And we're moving on. So the something that I noticed as we were digging into the adventure is that this reads very much like someone who does not do a lot of tabletop RPG adventure writing as their like daily activity. Mm-hmm. There's stuff. The one that really got me was there's a puzzle where you're supposed to walk through one of two archways based on some information you were given earlier in the adventure. And I'll mention this without spoiling it so that players don't have to plug their ears again. Basically, the correct solution lets you pass freely. The incorrect solution deals you 1d6 fire damage and then shunts you back into the place you were before. And I'm like, why does it shunt you back? What reason does it have to shunt you back? Especially when you're talking about two adjacent archways, they could both lead to the same place, y'all. This doesn't have to be it. When you go, oh, not only do you take fire damage, but you get pushed back into the room. Like that raises the adversarial nature of that encounter significantly. Mm-hmm. And I think people who spend a lot of time adventure writing and running those adventures know that. And they go, all right, there's two paths. They both go to the same place, but one of them is going to hurt you and it'll have a cost. And one of them will not and will be fine. And you'll have a great time getting there. And I think so that initially I was like, huh. This adventure has a few hiccups in it that don't suggest to me full-time TTRPG content creator.
Mm-hmm. It could also be just having to level set the writing for the intended audience, which, let's face it, is children.
Well, I'd argue then that having both paths lead to the same place is a better solution.
Mm-hmm.
Because children at tables that I have run, when you tell them they can't do something, are determined to figure out why and how to subvert it, because clearly there's a secret back there.
Mm-hmm. They're going to boundary break the whole thing.
They want to boundary break the whole thing. So if you go, both paths go to the same place, you take fire damage in one and you don't in the other, mm-hmm. then all of a sudden they're like, oh, well, I'm not incentivized to boundary break then. I'm just going to keep moving forward.
Yeah. I didn't read that puzzle. Was there any indication that through like scientific method or deduction or something like that, that lets the party sort of figure out which is the correct archway?
Yes.
Okay.
There is. And it's got to do with stars.
Oh, okay.
If you know a little bit about how stars are composed and how they burn and things like that, then you would be able to solve the puzzle very quickly with knowledge you have as a person.
Oh, okay.
And the punishment.
Oh, we'll come back to it.
1d6 fire damage. So it's not a big like, oh, you're really getting them with this. Like,
yeah.
If you're level 7 to 10. 1d6 fire damage is like, oh, well, that was mildly annoying.
Mm-hmm. Moving on.
Exactly.
Yeah. You said something and that reminded me of something I wanted to call out. You said, oh, well, like if you as a human, if, as a person, know sort of star composition and things like that, then you're going to be able to solve this puzzle. And I know immediately some people are like, oh, well, that's like not really fair because that's like metagaming. Well, this adventure is designed for metagaming, basically. Because the whole premise of it is sort of this Stargate Quantum Leap kind of situation where your characters are on Earth when the Hubble disappears, not just from orbit, but apparently from its entire timeline, which wisely the adventure just sort of hand waves as like time is complicated, you know, like wibbly wobbly timey wimey kind of thing, like retro causality, etc. And so you all get transported to this planet, but you're inhabiting the bodies of natives of this planet. So that's how you get to keep all your Earth science knowledge while you're on this magic planet that also, to be fair to them, has a tremendous bent toward science and academics.
Yeah. Well, and I also kind of like that when we're talking about TTRPG adventures that you can use to introduce a party to the concept of role-playing games, making it so that you don't have to role-play if you don't wanna is kind of nice.
Mm-hmm.
Because then people can literally just behave as themselves at the table and not feel weird about it.
Yeah. I had never seen a more irritated group of people than one time when I ran our Rainy Day adventure. Where, you know, people create a character, they show up to play, because normally we play pickup games for people who don't know. We like run pickup games for strangers a lot of the time, and they'll have a character, they'll bring it, they'll be ready to go. I'm like, okay, actually, what you're doing is you're playing as a small child in a suburban house pretending to be this character. So it's kind of like a double blind on them. And this is the exact opposite of that.
Yeah, some people love the concept of that adventure, and some people are like, well, no, because I'm a really powerful orc barbarian.
Yeah.
And it's like, yes, Timmy does believe that he is a very powerful orc barbarian.
Yes.
He is in it.
Yeah.
This
is why you have a session zero in actual regular games you have with people.
Yes. Yes, it is. So... the adventure overall, I think, is pretty well formulated. It's nothing too terribly complex, but you wouldn't want it to be too terribly complex. The science that's in it's pretty cool and is explained in a way that makes sense in universe, but also makes it a little bit easier to recall.
Mm-hmm.
And then they've also got some fun NASA history facts. They've got some information about the Hubble telescope up to and including one of those like blown out diagrams where you can see all the individual components.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole adventure is basically you arrive on this planet and you find out that they've been studying Earth to learn about how deep space works since they're hurtling through it. and they thought that the Hubble telescope was really cool. And they think that either they goofed something because they don't fully understand their magic, or someone was being malicious, and that's why the Hubble was removed from our timeline. Mm-hmm. And so it's up to you all. They are conscious of the Hubble and the fact that it's been removed. So it's up to you all and your adventuring party to figure out where it went and get it put back and rescue some research scientists that they had looking into the Hubble telescope that have also gone missing.
Mm-hmm. And it's got a lot of good resources throughout that sometimes I find myself wanting more of in more polished books. Like, it's got guides for role-playing particular NPCs. It's got really solid backstories for some of these NPCs, just to give you all the information you need to be able to play this with a group. Essentially, it's just, it's not leaving you wanting for much of anything in terms of that, because, like, let's face it, like, that can be some of the, like, the hardest stuff, especially if you're not an experienced GM. It's just like keeping all the character backstories in your heads and their motivations and all that stuff. So it's really nice that they provide you with that kind of resource in here to really sort of bootstrap you. Because, again, intended audience is children. So while, like, probably it's very likely that parents or adults will be running this for a group of children, like, it's, but you could have like a 11, 12 year old or something like that probably comfortably running this. I think
so too. I also something I used to do a lot more of was scripting for my NPCs.
Mm-hmm.
So like, oh, the party arrives in this room and here are the sorts of things the NPC is going to say. And I stopped doing that because, well, first of all, my GMs weren't using those scripts 9 times out of 10.
Mm-hmm.
And then on top of that, I was spending all of this time writing it, and then sometimes it didn't even apply at my table, the mm-hmm. scripts that I had written. So I was like, what is the point of this? Like, this isn't nearly, I should be giving you a general vibe of the person, the sorts of things they know, and then how they might share that information or under what circumstances they might share that information, and nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was reading through this adventure, all of the scripted sections, I was like, oh, there's so many scripts, like, jeepers, like, there's so many scripts. And then as I was thinking about, oh, you know what, this is not for your Sunday night D&D group to run, unless it's like for a gaff. Mm-hmm. This is for a classroom or a field trip or somebody like that to run as something kind of educational, but also literally everyone involved may have never run a TTRPG of any kind before.
Mm-hmm.
And under that circumstance, having all of your NPCs have scripts makes perfect sense.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's for what it's designed for. It's very well done.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of the criticisms that I had for the writing style were before I was really thinking, I was primarily thinking about it as a TTRPG module first, and then I started thinking of it as an educational resource. And the more I leaned into, oh, right, this is an educational resource, the more the few criticisms I had vanished.
Yeah, and it's fantastic. I'm looking at the Hubble diagram now. Like, that's just cool stuff that I still to this day as a grown adult enjoy looking at. I used to be such a big space nerd when I was a kid. I had tons of books. Like, even now, I still read a lot of that stuff. Like, I have a great book called, like, Red Sun in Orbit that came out, like, 30 years ago about the Russian space program. And it's a very svelte read, and I encourage anybody to take a look at it because it's just this fascinating look at the parallel side of the space race. But this kind of stuff I love. This was not written for me, though. Like, I enjoy that this exists, but I wouldn't enjoy playing it. And that's not a criticism of it itself. Like, what I want, NASA, if you're listening to me, here's what I want. I want some sort of cool system neutral tabletop game that takes place on Mars, like the maybe like 20 years after the first Mars colonists land or something like that, like some speculative fiction for something like that. I want a tabletop game that is set in a sort of blimp city in the upper atmosphere of Venus, where the air pressure and heat are manageable for humans, and we just have to wear masks to get oxygen. I want something that takes place like sort of like 2001 style on the like the Galilean moons of Jupiter. Use this to teach people about all those things. Like, this is great. And I love that we have this educational resource for the Hubble telescope. But if I had to level one criticism at this, is that they did not tie it back into our solar system to teach people more about that. Like, I don't know necessarily how I would have done that. So I really don't have any room like complaining. And I'm not complaining. I'm just observing. Like, I would have loved to have an adventure that's sort of set in our solar system that can help teach people about Mars, teach people about the colonization possibilities for Venus, which actually are brighter than that of Mars, right? Like, talk about Europa, talk about Titan, talk about the Pluto-Charon system, things like that. I want to see that. Please give me that, NASA.
I mean, Starfinder 2E is coming soon. So, you know,
that'd be
a good NASA, system for that.
NASA needs to make like a flavor book like you would find for like GURPS 4E, where it would just be just random flavor books about all kinds of stuff.
That would be pretty cool. I'm not going to lie. I think, to be completely honest, I think the reason you don't see that for something like this is that they wanted player characters to still be able to use magic, and mm-hmm. they still wanted magic to be part of what was going on, and mm-hmm. that's tough to do while also having it be set in our solar system. Yeah. Realistically,
basically, I want a tabletop science role-playing game instead of a tabletop fantasy role-playing game. Hey, well, speaking of settings with no magic, Lauren, when the Kickstarter for Born from Ice is finished and you've released that, I need you to make this Mars game for me. Because you'll already have all this experience making a no magic setting.
Born from Martian ice.
Born from frozen CO2. But getting back to Lost Universe again, I find it so funny, and for the video version, I'm going to put this up on screen, is because it's only a 44-page PDF, and it's free, obviously, so you should absolutely download it, and we'll have the link in the description. But I think it's really funny how you go through all this, and you have this very nice diagram with labels and measurements and all kinds of stuff on the Hubble telescope, and then the very next page is a very Tolkien-esque map of the planet Aldestron that you find yourself on, so much to the point that it's using like the Lord of the Rings font on the map and everything. I just the dichotomy there is just really funny to me. I think it's cool, and it's a really simple map. Like, it doesn't have a whole lot of detail, but it's very charming, and you can see like the bits on the map make appearances elsewhere in the book as little pieces of art and everything. So it's really cool.
Yeah. So credit to adventure writer Christina Mitchell, graphic designer Michelle Belleville. And then I'm going to run through them fairly quickly, and I hope I don't mangle any of their names. Development and editing by Kenneth Carpenter, Katie Caudry, Rob Garner, Carl Hill, Peter Jacobs, Jim Geletic, Esben Jepsen, Paul Morris, Gage Taylor, Elizabeth Tammy, and Lauren Ward, mm-hmm. who, at the very least, Christina Mitchell and Michelle Belleville are people who work at the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center doing other things as their day-to-day.
Yeah.
So this is, like, I don't know if this was purely a, like, marketing strategy kind of deal where they were like, hey, let's build something that's kind of fun and it'll make some news headlines, which huge success there if that was the goal, mm-hmm. or if they were more education focused and they were like, this will be something fun, and then it goes viral on them because mm-hmm. TTRPG nerds will absolutely promote the heck out of anything they find to be delightful.
Yeah And they have a fun little video on the Lost Universe site as well, And I encourage anybody to take a look at it because it's just funny because it's got, I've got it on screen for the video version right now, but it's got that Lord of the Rings font. It's got pictures, you know, video of like Hubble telescope in CGI. And then it's got a bunch of people sitting around playing the official NASA tabletop game and everything. It just, it's just an interesting mishmash of things. And I really appreciate it just as a way to just sort of unify different parts of nerddom. Like I said, this is not for me, but I really enjoy that it exists. And it's something that I think could be really fun to run for like some science enthusiast kids.
Oh, 100%. Absolutely. Yeah. And it's the sort of thing where if you have kids at home who are even like passingly interested in TTRPGs and you want them to learn a little bit more about space, you could run this for your kids at home.
Mm-hmm.
There's literally nothing stopping you.
Yeah. Yeah. It's actually probably like a really good homeschool resource, too.
I would think so.
Yeah. For something like that. But anyway, thanks, NASA, for putting some effort into this and releasing it, because I think it's cool. And I actually hope you do more of these. Like I said, I threw out some ideas there. You know, feel free to give me a call. happy to talk through that a little bit more. But I hope to see more of these. And, you know, I would love to see the National Museum, like the Smithsonian, do stuff like this for like paleontology, for archaeology, anthropology, things like that. That could be really fun.
Do an aerospace kind of like history of flight sort of adventure.
Yeah.
There's a lot of cool things you could do.
Well, I'll tell you, the Smithsonian actually recently did some weird licensing stuff. Like on my pinball machine back here, I have four tables and I have four tables from the Smithsonian on there because it's a digital machine. So I just have a bunch of tables on there. And like they partnered with the Smithsonian, At Games partnered with the Smithsonian to create these digital pinball tables. Like, you know, they never existed as real pinball tables. They're only digital. But there's one for like the Natural History Museum. There's one for the Air and Space Museum. And there's a couple of others, and they're fun. They're a little overdone, but that's because I tend not to like purely digital pinball machines. Like I like playing ones that could have existed in the real world, and these couldn't because of some of the stuff that goes on them. But anyway, they're really interesting. I have not learned a thing from them, but they're really fun. And I would like, since the Smithsonian seems to be very like willing to do stuff like that, I would love to see them do something like a TTRPG.
That would be really cool. I agree.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think that about wraps it up for us today. Josh, tell the people what they need to know.
They need to know that if they want to support the podcast, they can do that either by going to our Patreon, patreon.com/goblinsgrowlers, or by telling a friend about the Goblins and Growlers podcast. Because spreading the knowledge of things like the Lost Universe TTRPG and the fact that it's actually very delightful is something that you can rely on us to do for you so that you don't have to read an entire 44-page adventure to determine whether or not you're going to run it for your kids.
Yeah, absolutely. and I would say also, if you happen to be watching this on YouTube, subscribe to the YouTube channel. We're so close to having a nice round number of subscribers, and it's a small number, but it would make me very happy. Beyond that, there's the monthly newsletter that has cool stuff like gaming news. It has indie game suggestions, and it just sort of has a podcast recap on it as well if you just can't give the time, which is fine. Listen to Quid Pro Roll, a narrative play podcast that we're on in various capacities. We have a lot of fun with that. I'm a over the hill cowboy hat wearing wrestler. Josh is an edgelord thief in that.
And we frequently introduce random NPCs that have altogether too complicated backstories and the most ridiculous voices and mannerisms.
Absolutely. And I think that's it, other than to say, we will be at Triad Anime Con in Winston-Salem on the 29th, 30th, and 31st of March.
That sounds correct.
I think that's right. We will be doing panels and performances, and we'll also have a booth set up probably in the merch hall, the merch and autograph hall, because that's what it was last year. So if you are at all familiar with us, come by and say hi, and just make us feel good about ourselves because somebody knew who we were. And that's always nice.
We love to see your smiling faces, and it makes us feel important to know that people in other states are conscious of our lives.
Yep. And just one last call out for the Born From Ice Kickstarter, Lawrence Maul. Help him reach his goal on that, because I think it's a cool project. I have absolutely no stake in it other than I did back it at the $95 level to get the three books. But other than that, I have absolutely no connection to it other than it's the game that I've been wanting to be released for a long time. So if you don't want to help Lauren, you can help me. You can do me a favor and back help them.
Help Brandon help Lauren.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. but thanks, everybody. We will catch you again in a couple weeks. And by then, we'll have figured out what we want to talk about. We've got some ideas. So we'll see what happens. But thanks, everybody.
Bye, y'all. If you like what you hear, consider subscribing and giving us a review over on Apple Podcasts. Especially early in the feed, subscriptions and reviews are super helpful for bringing new listeners our way. Thank you!